Coming up next on This Week in Computer Hardware, killing SSDs. How long can an SSD last? AMD gains, DirectCU, PSU reviews, Origin gets returns, tablets are getting awesome, and a case for people that hate cable management. It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 231, recorded August 22nd, 2013. Cable management sucks.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Ting.com. Ting is a mobile phone service that makes sense. Save money with Ting. Pay for what you use. It does not require a contract and offers unlimited devices on one pooled plan. To save $25 on your first Ting device, visit twitch.ting.com. That's twitch.ting.com. And by ProXPN. ProXPN is a virtual private network that allows you to use the internet the way it should be, anonymous and unfiltered. For 20% off your new account, go to proxpn.com/twit and use the code Twitch.
Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, your weekly show on the Twit Network that aims to bring you the most informative, most important, most useful, and exciting news in PC hardware. We love the tablets, we occasionally talk about phones, and we always enjoy hearing from my partner in crime here, Mr. Ryan Shrout of PCPer.com. Are you there, Mr. Shrout?
I'm here, I think. Am I good? Can you hear me? Everybody can see me. Yeah. No, we're here. It's good. Another week.
Not dead yet.
It's not finished yet. Today's only Thursday. But as I'm sure we all get into the cycle where by the time it's Thursday, I'm already kind of worried about what's happening on Monday. And it's, you know, it's a cycle, believe it or not. You know, the weeks keep going.
A vicious cycle.
Keep that in mind.
Means you're not dead yet.
That's true. It's always a plus.
Another decade, you'll be excited to reach Thursday each and every week. Can I jump a story to the head of the line that I found so fascinating?
Is that okay? Sure, as long as Burke notices and he doesn't get things out of order, we'll be fine.
Well, okay, so it's a link off PCPer. It's pretty crazy. Tech Report is basically trying to destroy SSDs. It's really cool. Anvil Storage Utilities. It's a new utility. It's good to utility. That's why it's called Anvil Storage Utilities. But they have a test designed to determine the longevity of the flash storage inside SSDs, writes Jeremy. And so I love this so much. So Tech Report got 6 factory fresh solid state drives. Never had a bit written to them. They're going to try to write 22 terabytes. And then they're going to test the speed of the drives again. Will some fare better than others? Will some sacrifice capacity to keep their speed up? Stay tuned, writes Jeremy. Even with SATA 6 gigabits per second, it takes a while to write that much data. And the quote I got was, "We all know that flash memory has a limited tolerance for write cycling, but what does that mean for SSD endurance? We're testing 6 SSDs to failure to find out." So they posted that a couple days ago, 4:47 in the afternoon. Corsair Neutron Series GTX, Intel 335, Kingston HyperX, Samsung 840, 840 Pro. We've conducted a long-term test that will track a handful of modern SSDs as they're hammered with an unrelenting torrent of data over the coming weeks and months, and we won't stop until they're all dead. Welcome to the SSD endurance experiment.
It's interesting because it's, you know, there's two ways that SSDs can fail. There is right. actual wear or mm-hmm. there is just failure. And it'll be interesting to see, you know, if they'll hit one or the other first. You know, obviously in an ideal situation, the problem is you've got to have X number of test systems to kind of keep all this data going at the same time, you know, mm-hmm. is to have like 2 or 3 of each of those SSDs in order to say, get a better average or see if they're all very close in line or see if they vary quite widely. In terms of their wear rates and stuff. But everybody's got to start somewhere. It's actually a really cool experiment that Tech Report's doing with that. Did they give any estimate on how long they think this will take? I'm trying to think. He says in the conclusion, we'll see you again in 22 terabytes. So I assume that's when they're going to do their first checkup, but I don't know exactly how long that's going to take.
quote, if we assume modest write amplification and a 3,000 cycle write erase tolerance for the NAND, this class of drive should handle hundreds of terabytes of flash writes. So, yeah.
Alan Let's and I see. Were talking about this a little bit yesterday, too. And it's something that he's kind of done on the side as well. But we just don't have, I mean, I think they set up two individual systems, each with three different SSDs in it. And I think it takes turns cycling which one is actually being written to over and over and over and over again. So it'll be interesting to see what results they come up with for sure.
I think we're talking about months. Like,
yeah.
A month just to hit, I think it's like a month of 24-hour writes just to hit sort of the expected, and then to hit the theoretical life of the NAND will be many, many more months. Yeah, it's exciting.
It will, I'm just, you know, and the thing is you know that this may be the first time we've seen one of the review sites like us kind of do something like this, but all these manufacturers have done extended tests like this before.
They're and they've been so open about sharing. Share.
Yeah, exactly. They're maybe not real open to share it, unless right. It's about their competition, maybe, and kind of off the record. But I think it's really interesting to see. And I would be curious to see. They got six drives. You know, can we expand that out to 20 drives? And can we have one server powering all 20 of these and kind of cycle through them, and what kind of stuff can possibly get done with that as well? It's a cool idea. It's a long-term test. It's going to take a while to get a result.
Yeah. I was going to say, I have a funny feeling that the tech report will be happy to let you do your own extended testing on as many drives as you want in the future. Because you got to imagine, like, even if you can run multiple instances of this on a single motherboard, and I don't know if you can, I mean, you're literally talking about just hammering on a drive for weeks and weeks and weeks, you know, unless, of course, there's some terrible power outage that wipes it. Yeah, that would be horrifying. We've told you before, we'll tell you again, one of the most important components inside your PC, unfortunately, that people tend not to think about all too often, is the power supply, the PSU. You don't need, well, okay, some of you out there with three high-power GPUs need a 1500 or at least a 1200-watt power supply. The majority of us can get by with 500 or 800 watts. Interesting new example from Antec, the High Current Pro Platinum 850 power supply. And you guys ran it through the ringer. How did it hold up, man?
Very well, actually. So this new unit, it's an 80 plus platinum, which is like it's the highest efficiency rating from the 80 plus group, I guess. But it also means it's going to be more expensive, right? So even though it is an 850 watt power supply, its MSRP is $239.95. You could find it for about $210, $220, depending on where you're actually buying it at. So it's kind of expensive for the 800 to 850 watt range power supply, but it is very efficient. And that efficiency means it's going to lower your electric bill, not by a whole lot, right? But it will, right. It does help with that. But it also means the components that are inside the power supply are running cooler, and thus fans can spin less. Therefore, it can be quieter as well. So there are some other advantages besides just, you know, bill payments and wallet withdrawals and that kind of stuff. It's also got an interesting feature called, what do they call it? OC Link. And so if one 850-watt platinum power supply is not enough and you need more than that, they actually build in the capability to link two power supplies together so that they can be run in the same system. And cool. We've actually seen a couple of cases recently that support this. The Corsair 900D has support for two power supplies. And what you can do is, you know, you connect one master-slave, and when you turn on the master, it boots up the slave. And when you shut down the master, it shuts down the slave. And so the idea is, if you've got so many components inside your system that you have, maybe you have, you're one of those nuts that's got quad GPUs, but then you also have 10 hard drives and a bunch of other stuff like that, you can link these two power supplies. Maybe this feature is available on the 600s and the 650s as well. So maybe you already have a good 600 or 650. You want to add some GPUs. You don't necessarily want to replace your entire power supply. You can buy one of these and link them. So it's an interesting idea. It's obviously a very niche market for people that will need two power supplies. And it's not really in a fallback mechanism, right? It's not a redundancy issue like you may have seen on some servers and that kind of stuff. This is purely for additional power, not backup power. And there's actually there was a problem that Lee found with the OC Link, kind of in theory, is that there could be a problem where if the slave power supply shuts down or doesn't start up, maybe it's unplugged and you don't realize that, or the switch is turned off and you don't realize that, or if it encounters a fault and shuts down from overload or high temp or short circuit or something like that, the primary power supply doesn't know that that's happening. It doesn't, it's not an active communication between it. It's very much a passive communication, where when the master gets the power up, it passes the power up signal on. When it gets the shutdown signal, it sends a shutdown on. So if something happens to the master power supply, the slave will shut down. But if something happens to the slave power supply, it's not necessarily the case the other way. So something to keep in mind. It's not really recommending life support being built on this type of functionality. And we took that feedback to Antec, and they were actually pretty responsive to it and said, yeah, it's not something that's possible through the current configuration, but their next generation, they'll look at, can they add some logic in there that's very simple, that, checks back and forth for power on, power off states. And if something were to happen to one, the other one would shut off, and you would get the same, graceful, if you will, shutdown if you had a single power supply and pulled the power out from under it or something like that. So still a good power supply, even if you don't use the OC Link technology, though.
We've always preferred a graceful shutdown whenever possible. I was kind of hoping for like fail safe with the two power supplies in place. That would be so cool. Also probably pretty unreasonable.
Well, I mean, they do it in server markets, right? So it's not completely unreasonable.
Depends on what you're paying for it.
Exactly, right? And so the issue is cost. Is a consumer willing to do that? Power supply deaths, if you're buying a good one, are fairly rare these days. Not, gone completely. But I would say most people would agree that probably if you're buying a good quality one, there's a lot of other components that are going to eat it before your power supply will nowadays.
Good point. Asus DirectCU, that would be copper if I'm not mistaken. Updated lineup, NVIDIA GTX 700 edition. Quote, brand new GPU architectures are typically packaged in reference designs when it comes to power, PCB layout, and cooling, writes Josh Walworth. Once manufacturers get a chance to put out their own designs, then interesting things happen. The top-end products are usually the ones that get the specialized treatment first because they typically have the larger margins to work with. This is interesting. What's going on with the DirectCU, which is kind of the premier, I would call it the premier part brand, or the premier sort of the top of the title, the M5 or M8 or whatever BMW is up to. That would be sort of the equivalent of Asus DirectCU. It's interesting. DirectCU too, but they're doing some inexpensive cards along with the high-end cards.
Well, so what relatively essentially the direct
expensive cards.
Well, yeah. Comparatively, definitely. The DirectCU line is, Asus's custom PCB design, custom power delivery design, custom cooler design, as opposed to what you get most of the time with the initial launches, which is here's the reference card from NVIDIA or AMD with a different sticker on it, right? And so when you get into some of these bigger companies that have the capability to do unique designs like Asus and MSI, they do some really interesting things. And the DirectCU2 is kind of their this generation upgrade to a lot of those objects. And basically what Josh did in this article was kind of did a roundup of sorts, looking at the GTX 780, the GTX 770, the 760, and then the GTX 670 Mini, which is kind of unique in and of itself. So the 780, 770, and 760 cards are all, new-ish. The 780 being the GK110 base part, most expensive, $660, I think, but introduced, new power delivery mechanisms, new cool, I think it's a 10-millimeter heat pipe, which is significantly, it's the previous high that Asus was using was an 8-millimeter heat pipe, actually. It has 2,304 CUDA cores, right? I mean, it's an enormous graphics card. What I find interesting with these cards that Asus doesn't overclock these a lot out of the box, which I find a little confusing, right? These cards are built to be pushed. They're built to be overclocked. Right. They're built for over delivery on power and cooling and all that kind of stuff. And they don't really ship them that way. There's a lot of flexibility in the cards, but they tend to be a little bit more reserved on how they ship and let the consumer do all that, you know, see that as a positive or negative, if that's, you know, depending on your point of view. They have new fans on this. It's nice. They got things like super alloy chokes that, you know, if you want more details on that, definitely go check out the article. There's a lot of cool stuff in this. The GTX 770 is built off similar style improvements. The 760 is as well. Even though the 770 and the 760 are both GK104 chips, they're not really new. So they share a lot of similarities to previous generation cards. The 670 is interesting because it's DirectCU Mini, which is essentially, they took a GTX 670, which is a high performance card still. Right. It actually outperforms the 760 by a healthy margin. And they made it very tiny. If you scroll to the last picture on that page, you'll see that the PCB for it is very small. And that kind of gives you an idea of what it is in relative size. It's kind of built to be put into small form factor machines, home theater PCs, you know, little easy, quick take with you, you know, to BYOC PCs. And it's got a lot of horsepower in the size. Yeah, if you look at the 8-pin power connector there, you get an idea of kind of how the scale is, right? It's pretty impressive that they were able to get that much power there. Obviously, it's a little bit louder fan and it's a little bit hotter because it has a lot less space to work with, but it does pretty good.
Are they charging a premium for the Mini, like a vicious premium or just a modest premium for that?
Modest, I would say. It's not that much more than your standard GTX 670.
Cool.
And you know, it's obviously got some unique properties to it as well. So it's
nice.
I would say, you know, nothing, not one specific thing to take away from this article other than we often get requests for kind of roundups of these things. So if you're looking at which graphics card is right for me and you think you want to go on the NVIDIA side, you can look at a good 780, a good 770, a good 760, and even a 670 that's meant for smaller systems. It'll go in a bigger system, but it's meant for smaller systems. And you can get Josh's input and feedback on kind of how that all that worked out, see all the benchmarks, see how much he was able to overclock with the temperatures and that kind of thing all panned out to be. So
good to know.
More graphics cards.
Speaking of graphics cards, AMD gains GPU market share from last quarter. NVIDIA down 8%. Intel, well, pretty much stable at 6%. Overall shipments increasing 11%. What are we talking about? GPU, discrete GPU shipments. AMD, however, has experienced an increase in shipments of 47% for laptop APUs. I was discussing overall processor shipments, not just GPUs. I apologize.
The market share reports get really confusing, right? Because it's,
I think they're officially
GPU
weird
market share. Yeah,
it's GPU market share, but they're talking about APU, and two of them are primarily CPU manufacturers.
Okay, so they count the Intel GPUs, the Intel Haswell, Ivy Bridge, Sandy Bridge,
right.
All those processors that have graphics cores in them are included in this. And then the AMD APUs, the NVIDIA discrete, the AMD discrete. And that's why, you know, you look at those numbers where AMD has experienced increase in shipments of 47% for laptop APUs. And the desktop heterogeneous processors declined. Intel is obviously, you know, the reason for that, right? So if you look at the heterogeneous processors being the like Haswell and Ivy Bridge against the A10 and A8 series of APUs, that's kind of where the difference is there. And when you look at the, like that statement, AMD now enjoys a 5.8% lead in total market share over NVIDIA. That counts all of the graphics subsystems, the APUs, the discrete in the desktop world, the discrete in the mobile world, like laptops and that kind of thing. It's an interesting statistic from a business standpoint, but for the gamer side, I think that the next story that kind of looks at the add-in market exclusively is maybe more interesting because it talks about add-in GPUs very directly. And that's the one titled How Are Add-in GPUs Selling Anyway? But
and this is another John Petty research report. John Petty's kind of the godfather, the grandfather, the uncle, the sort of data maven for the sort of visual processing market, the GPU market, yep. formerly known as, you know, video cards. According to John Petty research, not too good if you're a Matrox or S3. And I was like, Matrox, I miss our Canadian friends. And S3, I didn't even realize was still shipping add-in GPUs.
Yeah, I don't know markets, what they are.
Market's down 5.4% from last quarter, 14 million shipped across the entire industry. Neither company accounted for a thousandth of that value, leaving them with a maximum 7,000 units shipped. Best case scenario, the industry is basically a two-horse race. We kind of knew that already. Who are the horses? Mm-hmm. AMD, Matrox with effectively 0%, NVIDIA with effectively, so AMD 38%, NVIDIA 62%, and S3 also with effectively 0%.
What do you think about the fact that, so if we look at previous quarter to this quarter, AMD did increase its market share from 35 to 38%, and NVIDIA's went down, you know, the same amount essentially. But yeah. NVIDIA still has the strong market leadership in discrete. What I would like to see is this a division of actual sales for that quarter, or is this now a new total division? I believe this is a new total market share division. And is that, you know, 2.5% increase on the AMD side significant considering all the weight they've put behind their marketing and the new products? And, you know, they did a lot of great stuff with game bundles that gamers seem to like.
You know, 40 to 38 sort of last year versus this quarter, like three, I've always kind of been trained to think that under 3% was in the margin of statistical insignificance. It's pretty close to a 60-40 split. I'm glad they're not continuing to go downhill, but they also had some sort of fights at price points last quarter. It's interesting, like, you know, 750,000 units. It basically means, you know, both of them are, they're holding steady. And it's kind of funny when you think about all of the issues. You know, they're both, okay, NVIDIA is building, you know, processors, they're building APUs, but they're doing it based on an ARM design. So there's a whole lot of legwork they don't have to do there versus what's going on at AMD. I'm kind of curious, you know. I like the summary that Scott put together there. In all, AMD has been doing better than the industry average. They are fighting the slight decline in the graphics industry while simultaneously helping GPUs hold off against larger declines in PC systems. You know, and it's funny, we've been saying this for a while. Most people, you know, if they're not doing really hardcore gaming or really hardcore video editing or really hardcore audio editing or working with gigantic files in Photoshop, you know, barely need a Core i5, much less a Core i7. And if you don't do a lot of multitasking, you probably don't need umpteen gigabytes of memory. So, you know, if these guys are holding relatively steady in the face of a decline on PC sales, that's probably a good thing. You know, I don't know if that's a particularly useful observation, but
I thought it was interesting. So they apparently had 14 million units shipped, but it was a 750,000 unit decline. So
split,
you know, they're fighting over a slightly smaller pie than there was last year. So
I would love to know how many of the cards
was happening.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be curious, like, what percentage of the cards sell at the above $500 level versus the below $500 level? And, you know, it's interesting, like, because from what the Petty Report says, apparently, you know, the market dropped 750,000 units, but that 750,000 was pretty much split 60-40 between AMD and NVIDIA. It's interesting. You know, I'm also kind of like, now I'm going to type in Matrox and see what their website looks like these days.
I hope it's not very sad and depressing. I really don't.
You know what's not sad and depressing? And I can guarantee it. Ting. Our sponsor, Ting.com. That's not boring at all. We want to thank them for sponsoring this episode of This Week in Computer Hardware. They are a no BS mobile service. I have two devices on Ting. They're an M, M, M I can't say this to save my life in the afternoons. MVNO, it's a reseller of the nationwide Sprint network. Ting's really, really simple. Here's the deal. They're going to give you the least expensive phone service you can get. They're going to make it as painless as possible. They're going to let you quit at any time without crazy, you know, termination fees or 2-year contracts. And they ask you to do one thing: buy your hardware from Ting or bring your Sprint hardware to Ting once it's open and unlocked. And they're going to make it as simple as possible. Beautiful website, easy to navigate, no weird bundles, no crazy ride-along services, no overage charges or penalties, voicemail, caller ID, tethering, hotspot, three-way calling, call forwarding, and other features, all part of the service. No add-on charges. No, wait, but my phone already does this, but I have to pay you $35 a month to make it do this? Ting is not going to do that to you. No weird light items on your bill. And you can basically add as many devices as you want to one plan. Could be great if you've got a big family or a small business to manage. Each individual device on a plan costs $6, which I think is pretty reasonable compared to what I'm currently paying for the primary family phones, which I want to get rid of and get us on Ting. It's cool. Their website's fantastic. They've got a great account control panel. I've dealt with customers before twice about bringing a device. I had a question about whether I could bring a device onto Ting. Somebody nice answered the phone. It's pretty cool. Call them between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern Standard. Somebody's going to answer the phone. They sent me a beautiful summary email after the call was over, basically going over what we discussed and telling me what the next steps were. It's cool. And the truth is I had kind of an obscure question that I couldn't find on help.ting.com, and they helped me out on the phone. It's really, 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 really cool. Ting breaks out your rates by minutes, text messages, and megabytes. They bill you at the end of the month for what you've used. And it's cool. Purchase your mobile device from Ting. They send it to you in 2 to 5 business days. Activate your device with Ting. You have the option to select a new phone number or port an existing one. It's good stuff, people. I'm really enjoying it. It's given me a very affordable way to experiment with Android. It's given me an extremely affordable way to have a mobile data device, a hotspot, because I bought a relatively inexpensive hotspot. I took advantage of the cool deal we're going to tell you about in a second to make that wireless router even less expensive. And now I can have data I need in emergencies without paying $60-$75 a month for data I mostly don't use. Twitch, twich.ting.com. We'd love you to visit Ting today. Twitch.ting.com is the place to go if you want to support our podcast. Save money. Better manage your mobile phone usage with Ting. Check out their savings calculator and see how much you or your company can save. And you, by the way, because you're a Twitch fan, can save $25 on your first Ting device when you sign up. So please visit twitch.ting.com and start saving today. And we want to once again thanks Ting for their support of the Twitch podcast. This Week in Computer Hardware brought to you, ladies and gentlemen, by Ting. So, or I should say twitch.ting.com. Go there. Go there now. Sign up. Save money. Keep the podcast flowing, people. Sorry, indeed. I get excited, man.
Let's talk about something interesting. Origin, which is a PC game distribution application. Portal,
EA's Steam competitor, right?
It is a Steam competitor that came out to, I think, many people's dislike. Right. Well, everybody liked Steam. They're like, what can you possibly do to make things better? They haven't really done that. They didn't really make anything better. But this was an interesting announcement that I think PC gamers are going to want to pay attention to. They announced a return policy for digitally distributed games, which is something that Steam does not have. Right. And the return policy is like this. I'll get your feedback on it. any EA game purchased on Origin is eligible for a full refund within the first 24 hours since the game was first launched, the first time you started it. This refund policy is limited to 7 days after purchase, or if you pre-ordered, 7 days after release. So essentially, within that first 7-day window, after the first time you started, you have 24 hours to decide if you want to keep this game or return it. And you apparently will be able to get a full refund. And that's not something Steam can really compete with, because with Origin, EA is the publisher of all those games. That's kind of the whole idea. And Steam has tons of publishers that they work with in that regard. So what do you think?
Do I have to buy EA games to use it? Yes, that's part of the problem for me. I don't play Sims, and anybody who buys Sims isn't going to return this. I think it's nice. I don't think EA, you know, it's funny, EA for all their faults, cue angry email to Twitch at twit.tv, but EA for all its faults generally ships relatively complete video games, at least in my modest experiences with EA, unlike some other game vendors that kind of ship you a late alpha or an early beta and then hope their updates are done by the time you get the game installed. So
I like the idea. So when we talked about the Xbox One and the PS4 release, with the Xbox One, there was this whole idea of being able to share this game with your friends. And there's a whole lot of discussion about what are these new digital rights that you're going to have with this kind of distributed game. And I told some people, we were talking about this on the podcast last night as well, and Ken was here and he was young enough. He didn't remember a time where you could buy a game for the PC and actually return it. And I remember those days. You used to be able to buy it and return it. If it didn't work or if you didn't like it or whatever it was, you could return it. They eventually stopped that due to piracy issues. But the fact that they would say, hey, if you try this game and it doesn't work on your system or you just think it's awful or you don't want it anymore, we'll give you your money back. And nobody else really has ever really tried to do this. I think the Google Play Store does this still. I think you have 24 hours after you download an app to uninstall and get a refund. And because it's digitally distributed and they don't have to worry about, has this been pirated at all, that they see a little bit less risk at this point in time than they would have previously.
Do you think it's them seeing less risk or them just looking for anything to help them claw their way into a better looking position against Steam?
Well, I mean, I'm sure that's 100%. Oh, I mean, that's definitely why they're doing it. They're like, well, how can we make ourselves stand out as the place to buy our games? Besides the fact that it's the only place where you can digitally download most of these games, you know. But then they had to look. Somebody had to make that suggestion, and then somebody had to look at it from a financial standpoint and go, how much is this going to cost us if we actually offer this? And they came to the conclusion that, you know, it's something worth trying. We were joking earlier about, well, it's too bad. Maybe it's not a coincidence this happened after the SimCity launch, and so far after the SimCity launch, when everybody would have been returning that game because it wasn't working or it was completely opposite of what people had expected it to be, you know, when they were first learning about the development of the new one. So it'll be curious. Like, you know, the next giant EA game to come out is going to be Battlefield 4. It's next month. September, October, I don't know which one it is. And
maybe they'll exempt it from returns. Oh, by the way, Burke wants us to know that the Play Store has a 15-minute return policy.
Oh, it's 15 minutes. Oh.
Yes.
Okay.
It's been a while since I've seen Burke turn on the blinking GIF font in the Google font.
At least that gives you time to, if it doesn't run, you can just refund it right there, which is important for the Android marketplace where there's a lot of different systems and it may or may not work on your device. So iOS doesn't really necessarily have that problem. So I still think it's cool. Yeah. Do I love Origin now? No, but you know, it's bad.
I'm thinking of a game I spent. There it is. Command and Conquer. I spent $10 buying that for the iPhone and it never actually finished a complete game because it crashed before it did anything useful.
And you can't get your money back.
Never could.
Nope. If you had bought it on Origin somehow, some way in the far flung future, you could have done that.
Don't tease the animal. Sorry. PS4 and Huma debate. So, Huma, HUMA, is the. So the idea is AMD's Huma memory architecture essentially pools graphics memory, main system memory, which is so 1999, I can't even bear it. But the heterogeneous unified memory architecture. And the argument is whether or not the PlayStation 4 is actually AMD Huma or not, or if it will actually utilize AMD Huma with the Kabini-based system on a chip. Ryan, you wrote this up, so I'm going to stop speaking now and let you get vicious on the details.
The story was yesterday somebody published that they were at Gamescom, which is going on in Germany right now. And they said, we talked to an AMD rep, and he said that, as it turns out, the PS4 is going to be quite a bit faster than the Xbox One because it has support for HUMA memory, which is heterogeneous unified memory architecture. And what's interesting about HUMA is that not that it has a pooled...
Say it again.
I'm trying to debate how I want to pronounce it. HUMA? HUMA?
I like HUMA.
Yeah. It's not just pooled memory. It's the fact that it can be separate memory, but the processor can access and read memory on the GPU side of things without and change things without having to go through a bunch of different protocols, and vice versa, the GPU can access CPU memory. And it's kind of like the step before full HSA compliance, where they actually completely share the same memory address space. And there's been a lot of confusion about which platforms are going to support which, because they are custom designs. They are both the Xbox One and PS4 are using AMD APUs, kind of based around the Kabini design. They're using Jaguar cores, GCN-based right. architectures. But they obviously, as we've talked about, they use different memory systems. One uses a GDDR3 memory system. One uses a GDDR5. One has like a local cache, and one does not. Mm-hmm. And so the idea that the PS4 would be faster because it has support for HUMA was kind of interesting.
Right.
And so I emailed people at AMD. I said, so is this true? And they came back with one of those PR responses that you get sometimes. Our spokesperson made inaccurate statements about our semi-custom APU architectures and does not speak for Microsoft, Sony, or the AMD semi-custom business unit responsible for co-developing the next generation console APUs. So
now let me translate for a moment. This often means somebody told you something honest and useful, but we want to deny it. Or it could mean somebody thought they understood it, but they didn't. Or what else could it mean? Or does it really matter?
I mean, that's pretty much it, right? So it's either, damn, you weren't supposed to find out about that, and now a lot of people are going to be pissed at us, so let's deny it. Or that's not right, but we can't tell you what is right, so you're just going to have to say that it's inaccurate. And when I talked to them two or three times today, I thought, how about you just tell me something that will clear up the confusion, because that's what's going back and forth now, is which story does that tell? You know, my initial take on the discussion I had, the email exchange I had, was that, oh no, it's incorrect. PS4 doesn't use a heterogeneous unified memory architecture. But then more and more people were talking about, hey, Mark Cerny from Sony and these guys during the announcement talked about unified memory architectures. And I was like, okay, well, maybe they're using not an AMD built heterogeneous unified memory architecture, but they're using something that they custom built themselves, because it is a semi-custom APU. It's not exactly an off-the-shelf AMD part. And then there was talk of, hey, there's these Microsoft developers saying that their development codebooks say that they have access to heterogeneous memory as well. So maybe they both have it. And what was incorrect was that the PlayStation 4 would have an advantage because of it. So no firm answer, but I'm kind of with you. With your first hypothesis was that chances are somebody told somebody the truth on accident when they didn't mean to, or when they shouldn't have, you know, and their boss didn't say, hey, make sure you don't tell anybody this, but, and now they're trying to do damage control. Because there are billions of dollars on the line with these two customers, and they don't want to piss anybody off.
I gotta say, it was funny. It was like, you know, cause it's not a true heterogeneous system architecture. You know, that's kind of a ways out in the purest sense, right? But it was funny because I've had some friends who are fairly nerdly are like, HUMA and Sony's going to kick ass. And I'm like, HUMA's not entirely a shipping product. You know what I mean? It was just like my first thought, and I don't, you know, I don't want to sound cruel, but my first thought was like, you know, it's not entirely shipping. And, you know, difficulties in shipping not entirely finished stuff nearly killed off, or effectively, you could say, killed off a lot of the mobile market for NVIDIA's APUs, their mobile APUs. You know, I keep thinking of Boxy. What a different story Boxy might have been if their hardware wasn't 6 months late because the NVIDIA Tegra 2 turned out to be so difficult to finish. So it was funny because I just remember thinking like, yeah, that would be really cool. It's not quite an HSA. It's not quite what you think it is. And I just kept thinking, wow, it's a gutsy move by Sony if they can actually get this not entirely homogeneous memory architecture to work. It's interesting. I mean, I'm really curious to see, you know, I'm really curious to see both units, but I can't help but think the performance from these is going to be astonishingly close. And there's going to be, you know, will there be any real way of testing it? And does it matter for that much? Because the other thing we keep getting is like, we've got a lot of questions on Tekzilla lately where people are like, well, in HD Nation for that matter, well, what's the bottlenecks on these? Well, nothing unless you want 4K higher than 30 hertz, which, you know,
another interesting point that people haven't thought about in terms of the performance side is the Xbox One is going to use DirectX and the PS4 is going to use OpenGL. So they don't even share the same graphics API. So even if, you know, people are thinking about how can we hack our way in and like put a benchmark application on these to run them because they're x86 based. I imagine that will happen sooner rather than later when these systems are out there. But they're fundamentally going to be running different APIs. So you can't even really take the same application and run it on the Xbox as you would on the PS4. So
do you feel that OpenGL is even remotely as well optimized as DirectX is at this point in terms of gaming performance?
It will be if it's not, right? I mean, it's for AMD, it will be come November 15th. They obviously had to prove to Sony that they were able to make this happen and that they were going to, you know, make these as close in performance as possible. Otherwise, you know, they might have gone towards NVIDIA for a discrete GPU on the PS4. So
that could be, I mean, that could be really good for OpenGL as you know, just OpenGL outside of gaming or outside of consoles. If somebody goes through the steps to actually make OpenGL perform better, that's always been a traditional issue. Tablets. Oh, my goodness. And Antec did its review of the Nexus 7, the 2013 Nexus 7. And, you know, it's Anand at his finest. He is taking names and kicking ass and benchmarking stuff. I had no idea you could benchmark under Android. It's pretty cool. But what kind of blew me away was like four column inches into the article was looking at the comparison between the Nexus 7, the 2012 Nexus 7 and the 2013. So you scroll down a little bit and the dimensions are roughly the same. So it's, oh wait, it's 10.45 millimeters now down to 8.65 millimeters. And we've jumped from a 1280 by 800 screen to 1920 by 1200. They've dropped 40 to 50 grams off the weight. They've gone from a Tegra 3 to a Snapdragon S4, doubled the amount of RAM, doubled the amount of storage, the battery size in terms of watt hours is relatively similar. They've added 802.11a to BGNN, Bluetooth 4.0, which means you're going to have some superior Bluetooth longevity, battery life. And it's interesting, the price went up a whopping $30 for the 16 gigabyte version, where I should take it back. So they've gone from 8 gigabytes to 16 gigabytes as an entry level, and they've only gone up $30. So I was amazed at how absolutely kick ass this thing is for $230. And of course, it's going to be a pure Android experience, which the more I play around with Android, I love you, Samsung, but we got to talk about this stuff you lay on top of Android. It just upsets me. But it's a good-looking piece of hardware. 5-megapixel camera is not the greatest camera. It's not the fastest device out there, but it's, you know, it's basically in the middle of the benchmarks. But it's funny, if you want to see some pretty feral benchmarking, you can take a look at sort of the Calman display graphics. Display brightness measurement. It is the brightest display. This is going to be a fantastic, like I now want to use this, you know, this is ridiculous. 583 nits. That is a huge amount of light to be pumping out of a 7-inch screen. You know, 300 to 400 is considered ridiculously bright for a laptop. The Galaxy Note is at 480. the Galaxy Tab 415, the iPad 4 407, the iPad Mini 378. That is a lot of light and a huge jump from the original Google. Apparently, you know, perhaps Google Nexus 7 users were complaining about its usability outside because they went from 312 nits to 583 nits. This is just interesting. Pixel density is now 323 pixels per inch, which puts it above everything in the planet except for the iPhone 5. It's going to be, you know, it's going to be a good looking tablet. And I want to buy a tablet. I got to read more about the GPS. He does a pretty good analysis of how the GPS works. But Asus taking taking ass kicking to a new level for Google. So this is, I just thought it was interesting to see how much you were getting for literally about the same amount of money. Like $230 is not a lot of money for the amount of computing power you're getting inside of that. The other thing I thought was interesting, Delta of all people, I've been wondering now if phones might be the future for verticals or if this is just a case where phones fit better in the tiny confined spaces inside planes better than tablets do. But Delta is buying probably the single largest purchase of Lumia 820s ever. 19,000 Windows 8 phones, Lumia 820s for basically their entire pool of flight attendants. They have AT&T services, but they're going to be using Wi-Fi and LTE for customer services, real-time credit card processing for onboard purchases, i.e. if you're buying a drink, e-receipts to email to customers, prepaid credit cards for onboard purchases. Apparently, they're frustrated with the transaction times and their existing hardware. And quote, in the near future, the ability to read coupons displayed on a customer's mobile device. And apparently, they're going to continue to upgrade the handsets to the latest coming out from Nokia. I thought that was really interesting, the idea, because we've seen a lot with verticals on tablets, right? You know, the hospitals, insurance adjusters, you know, contract operations. There's a whole lot of areas where we always think of tablets as being sort of, you know, I want a display, I want check boxes, I want a simple interface, I want something that's going to be relatively bomb-proof in the field. I've seen a couple of beautiful devices that are put together by companies that are basically building you know, not quite Legos, but pick and choose platforms so that, you know, if you have 230 drivers for your concrete business, they can all basically update your data in real time and streamline the entire process and eliminate paperwork. And it's really cool. And it's, a lot of people think it's really boring, but I was like, wow, you know, phones instead of, I thought using phones instead of tablets is really interesting, or maybe really obvious if you're talking about having to move around in a plane with 80 more seats than it was designed for originally.
Nice.
But it's an interesting article up on GigaOM. Flying high, Delta equips 19,000 flight attendants with Windows phones, which ends on the note that Microsoft Windows Phone has moved from fourth to second place in Latin America for the second quarter of 2013, which has to make people in Microsoft really, really, really happy after what I affectionately think of as the great Windows RT debacle, or the mother of all write-offs. Kevin Toffel up at GigaOM wrote that one up. One last one before I go, to feed my obsession with 3D printers. We're learning more and more about 3D printing, which is not quite as simple as it looks on the surface. No surface pun intended. But it's interesting. So, last week and a half ago, MakerBot was brought by Stratasys, which is, I don't even know how to describe it. Like, Stratasys is like hardcore, expensive, multi-zillion dollar or tens of thousands of dollars industrial 3D printing machines. You know, if you've been watching, you know, mainstream news and they're talking about people printing guns, mayhem in the streets, they were probably using a Stratasys printer or renting time in a Stratasys printer to do that. They're incredible systems. So they actually bought little old MakerBot, Brooklyn's finest, a few weeks ago. And MakerBot is finally in October going to be shipping their new digitizer. Now we've seen DIY digitizers, which we've seen just there for a moment was Bree Pettis, the founder of MakerBot, showing off the new digitizer. But essentially one of the biggest challenges, and this may be a dumb moment for everybody listening, and you can point at me and laugh, that's okay. But creating STL files, creating 3D digital objects, is extremely complicated if you are not gifted in working in 3D applications. But digitizers are traditionally incredibly expensive. There's been some interesting hacks that allow you to use a series of printed dots in a 90-degree corner with a webcam to create it. But this is one of the first time we've seen a really affordable desktop 3D scanner. And then, I mean, for me, this is really interesting because the last time I saw anything like this was when 2D printers, laser printers came out, and I want to say the late 80s or early 90s. It was a long time ago, so I can't quite remember. but it's pretty cool. Basically, it's a little round turntable in the middle. You put an object on it, you spin it around, it scans everything in. Quote, MakerBot says the whole process takes about 12 minutes, after which you're able to push the file to a 3D printer of your choosing and have a grand old time, unquote.
So what is this now? For about $5,000, you can get this and the printer?
Yeah, their latest printer, I want to say, is about $2,000. It's kind of amazing. Like, we've been playing around with two printers here at TechZilla, one of which is, one's a PrinterBot Simple. It sells for $299. It kind of looks like a construction set, right? So printerbot.com/shop/printerbot-simple. Because it's a kit you build yourself, or you spend an extra $100 and have them build it. And then a 3DS printer, which is like a $1,300 printer. And there's some technological advantages to the printer that costs $1,000 more, but they both still have some of the same barriers to entry for newbies. And those are just the 3D printing process is kind of complicated and kind of intense. Once you start getting objects coming out of it, it's really cool. But it's harder than desktop publishing used to be, probably because you're working in three dimensions instead of two. But there's an interesting learning curve. But once you start getting over the learning curve, silly things like realizing that if you create something, say with a neck that sticks forward like a dinosaur, the printer is going to have to basically print a bridge towards the front of the dinosaur to hold its head up so it doesn't collapse under the printing process, right? It sounds right. Obvious when you think about it, but when you're printing it, when you're first printing a design and this weird thing pops up, you're like, what the hell is that? And then you realize there's a finishing process, and it's all very early. The Stratasys stuff that costs $30,000 or $100,000 is a little farther along evolution-wise, but it's also an order of magnitude or more expensive. In any case, I promise not to talk any more about 3D printing this
printing.
Week.
Printing. Let's take a quick minute here. Take a quick minute here. Thank our second sponsor for today. That is our friends at ProXPN. ProXPN is a global VPN, virtual private network, that works with almost any internet connection. It creates a secure, encrypted tunnel through which all of your online data passes back and forth. Any online application can work with ProXPN, including your web browser, your email, your file sharing, instant messaging programs, all that will work. It keeps everything you do online hidden from prying eyes, disguising your physical location, and giving you unfettered access to the web and online services, no matter where you live or travel to. So I travel a lot. We use a lot of public Wi-Fi. And what makes ProXPN nice is that you get things like complete online privacy through that 512-bit encryption tunnel. It works via OpenVPN or PPTP. You get to choose which one you use there. You can protect yourself against your ISP's six strikes rule using this software. You keep your personal internet usage private at work, bypass internet filtering and blocked websites and geographical restrictions. ProXPN makes your internet connection, quote, region free, which is nice. It has software for Mac and Windows. It offers advanced controls, allowing you to select the programs and ports you want to anonymously route through ProXPN servers. It works with your iOS and Android device, allowing you to use your data plan or public corporate Wi-Fi with complete and total privacy on the go. No app is required for that. There's also a new ProXPN app for Android in the Google Play Store that supports OpenVPN. Even better, they have world-class customer support, and even Steve Gibson gave it a great review on Security Now, so that says quite a lot. All you have to do is go to proxpn.com/twit for more information. That's proxpn.com/twit. You can sign up there. ProXPN premium accounts are normally $9.95 a month or $74.95 for an entire year, but we have a special offer. If you use the code Twitch, T-W-I-C-H, you can receive 20% off for the lifetime of your account. That's less than $5 a month on the yearly plan. If you're not satisfied, you can cancel within 7 days for a full refund. Again, that is proxpn.com/twit. Use offer code Twitch to give ProXPN a try. We thank ProXPN for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. And it's pretty cool. If you travel at all, or you are just worried about people looking at you, or over your shoulder, rather, while you're watching This Week in Computer Hardware, you can use ProXPN and filter all that through.
Keep them out of your bits. Thank you very much, guys. Yeah. Thank you, ProXPN. Got an email from Chris about an upgrade direction for his GPU. He says, I've been listening to other Twitch shows for quite a while, recently stumbled upon Twitch. However, the obvious side effect of this discovery is the feeling that everything I own is obsolete and must be upgraded immediately. We will work hard to kill off that effect, Chris, but we suffer from it ourselves. I've been looking into getting a new video card for my full tower desktop PC, which was the first computer I've ever built. That is now over a year old. To save money back then, I skimped a little on the video card. It's only a GTX 560 and non-TI. After hearing your coverage of the GTX 760, I decided that it was the card I have to have, but I'm not so sure. I would rather spend a little extra money towards future-proofing instead of buying another cheaper graphics card and then having to replace it again in a couple years. With that in mind, I've also been looking at the GTX 770, which has a Passmark score twice that of the 560. My question is, which card do you think I should get? I'm wary of the idea of going for the 760 with the idea of planning for an SLI configuration later when I need more performance, as it doesn't take more than a Google search or two to come across compatibility horror stories, usually games that don't support SLI, NVIDIA doesn't have a driver that supports a particular game, or if NVIDIA supports the game, they do so poorly. Is the GTX 770 worth the money? Are the SLI horror stories just from a bunch of whiners? Right now, I'm only gaming on a single 1080p 60 hertz monitor, although because I've been listening to your show, I've also been toying with the idea of getting another one. So there's that to consider as well. Oh, my goodness. I feel like such a pusher of technology right now.
Sometimes I do feel that way. Sometimes I do that feel that way. I will say, speaking of pushing, if you're going to buy a second 1080p monitor for gaming purposes, you should really buy a third, because there aren't very many gaming situations where two monitors is that much better than one. Because if you're playing a game where you're focused on the middle, if you have two displays, that bezel is going to be right in the middle of where you're cursor is going to be, your reticule, whatever it is. If you're playing a first person shooter, that's where the aiming is going to be. So you either want, you need them in multiples of odd numbers. You need 1, 3, or 5. Just say,
or just get a cat leap,
or you get one bigger, one higher resolution 2560 by 1440 panel, or save up a whole bunch of money and get one of those $3,500 Asus 4K displays, I would say. Yeah, see, that doesn't look great. If you're aiming right down where the bezel is, that's not the best.
Even the color calibration, by the way, if you're going to get a second or third monitor, try to buy the monitors all at the same time in the vainglorious hope that their color will be relatively close, because there's usually a limited amount of calibration on the monitors. There's things you can do, but that's a subject for another question. SLI horror stories, whiners or true?
I mean, there's definitely more complication when you use two GPUs to get to a performance level than you do a single GPU for a performance level. Of the two competitors, AMD and NVIDIA, NVIDIA still has the best multi-GPU support comparatively, you know, and it's by a pretty good shot, right? So with AMD's Catalyst 13.8 driver beta they released a couple of weeks ago, they improved their multi-GPU support quite a bit on those single monitor configurations. It's not fixed for triple monitor like iFinity or anything like that yet. But I wouldn't say you should be fearful of going to SLI for any particular reason, but I've always been of the mindset that if you can, I would always recommend getting the larger single GPU. It gives you more flexibility in the long run. It's going to last you longer without having to get into SLI. And then if you still, you know, maybe by then you don't hear any of those horror stories about SLI anymore, you can add another 770 on top of that, and you're still further ahead than you were before. Between the 760 and the 770, I would probably, so the 770 is $399. The GTX 760 is, let me double check here, $259 or so. So you're talking about a $140 difference for a pretty substantial performance delta there. I would probably lean towards the 770. The 770 is essentially a GTX 680. So if that helps you put anything else into perspective in terms of other benchmarks that you've seen or other results or anything that your friends might have, a 770 is a higher clocked GTX 680. So yeah, and we're showing there the 770 versus the 760 there, the Passmark scores, which I hate using single, you know, kind of synthetic benchmarks, but it looks like the 760 is getting around 5,900 and the 770 is getting like, what does that say, 6,300? That's not 5,900, is it? That's 5,015. versus 6,257. Yes, that's quite a big difference there. So you're 5,000 versus 6,200. So it gives you an idea of maybe what percentage difference you're looking at there in terms of just raw performance.
Right.
I think the 770 is a really good card. And if you can afford to spend the $399 on it, you might be able to get them on sale for $380 or $375. I think that's your better option for that long term goal, right? So he says he just built his system a little over a year ago, and now he's looking at upgrading. I think if you get to 770, you'll be able to wait, you know, longer than that before going down that upgrade cycle again. So
it's one of the advantages if you stick with the 1080p monitors, that GPU is going to last you a lot longer. Is it worth waiting? Don't expect any major GPU updates between now and the end of the year. Do we expect any price drops that are worth waiting for between now and the end of the year?
There's a pretty good chance that AMD is going to have new GPUs before the end of the year. Mm-hmm. But I don't know when exactly. It might be like the very last day of the year. price drops. I don't think we'll see any price drops unless AMD comes out with that new series of GPUs. If they do, then chances are you'll see NVIDIA price drops. And maybe you'll start to see some of the 7000 series price drops as well. Pop-Tart cat.
sorry.
I wouldn't count on any of that happening in the next 30, 60, probably even 90 days at least.
All right. Fire up your credit card, Chris. This is going to be a bumpy ride. By the way, make sure you have at least 8 gigabytes of memory.
Yeah.
While you're ordering that, get yourself 8 gigabytes of memory. It has nothing to do with the GPU, but I just think you should have at least 8 gigabytes of memory. And if you don't have a SSD, get an SSD too. We're going to hurt your credit card. We got an email from Jonathan about cases in space. He says, love the show. I'm currently in the process of my second build. My first was an AMD build. And this one, I want it to be Intel using the new fourth gen. Anyways, I have all my parts picked out. And this is where my question is. I'm currently torn on which case to choose. There are just so many options, but my main concern is cable management. I'll admit it. I still have poor cable management skills. Don't feel bad, because the only person who has worse cable management skills than Ryan is me. And I manage cables like an angry four-year-old flinging spaghetti, and that's when I'm careful. I'm teasing Ryan, but I think both of us find cable management to be the least enjoyable and most frustrating aspect of building a PC. Jonathan's been looking at lots of case reviews, but hardly any of them actually address the amount of space behind the motherboard panel. And if they do, they just show you, which is extremely difficult to judge on screen. My question is, what are some good cases that have voluptuous, that's a word I've not really ever associated with a case before, voluptuous amounts of cable management? As far as aesthetics go, it's not too big of an issue. Also, I'm looking into a mid tower or full tower, preferably a full tower. Thanks, guys, and keep up the great work. Thank you.
I got the perfect case for him.
Oh, man.
It is the Corsair Carbide Air 540.
Is this the one that like hides everything behind a panel?
Yeah. So it's kind of like shaped like a cube. So you've got your motherboard on one side with all the other components, and you've got your power supply and optical drives on another side. It's kind of two separate compartments almost back to back. And nice. It's an interesting looking case. We did a video of it that we haven't actually published it yet, so I can't throw a link in there, but I'll try to get it up tomorrow on pcpro.com. But the inside of it is very cool, how it kind of compartmentalizes things. And interestingly, on the back where your power supply is, there's a ton of room. You're probably talking 4 or 5 inches of space.
Oh, wow.
Because it has to be wide enough for the power supply to sit back there. And then there's places for optical drives and some SSDs, but there's a whole lot of empty space back there that if you just want to shove the cables in and not worry about it, you can absolutely do that. And it's a Corsair case, so it still has all of the cable routing grommeted holes that go through to the middle, right? To the other side, right? So you know, you're still, the things where the window is still look very clean. But you've got lots of space for, you know, all the other power supply cables that you want to bundle up and kind of tie off and all that kind of stuff. If you're looking for pictures, Burke, look up Corsair 540. And it'll be like it's a black one. It's kind of shaped like a cube. And it's, I actually saw quite a few of these at QuakeCon. It's pretty handy for case mods, right? It's because of its unique shape. It's more flexible. Yeah, that's it right there. It's more flexible for case modification. So that right hand side where see the two optical bays kind of perpendicular. Yeah, there you go. So the entire width of that right hand side is where you'll have space to put cables because your power supply sits on that. There you go. There you go. So you can see the power supply there. You see the optical drive. And you can see the CPU backplate opening. And then the rest of that space is available for mashing your cables in or hiding things mashing. If you want to do that, I guess. And
what was the name of that case again?
It's the Carbide Series Air 540. So it's the Carbide Air 540. And it's not that expensive. It's like $140. You can probably get it for a little bit cheaper than that if you look around. It's not the only case that has a lot of room behind it, obviously. Right. But it's just the one that I happen to have. It's literally... I think it's sitting on the floor around my desk here, actually. And it, like, when we did the review, that was one of the things that I brought up specifically was, hey, if you want a lot of space in the back side of the case, you don't, like, right. My complaint was always that you get those bundles of wires and you only have, like, an inch or an inch and a half on that area. Sometimes getting the door closed is a pain in the butt, right? Or when you do get it closed, yeah. You see, like, this kind of bowing in the middle where you know that's where that bundle of cable is that you zip tied up. Mm-hmm. Sitting right there, and it's really annoying. And this kind of prevents all of that from happening. So it's unique. You have to like what you see when you look at the case, obviously. But if you do like it, that's definitely going to fit specifically his concern about PC cases. So
I will admit that one of my reasons for buying an Antec P183 for the sort of media server, I built sort of a small, not the RIP monster, but a smaller RIP box / media server for the house. The Antec P183, one, because it has all of this stuff designed. Basically, it's built to be a sound absorbing case. It's got multiple panels. It's got rubber inside. It's got isolation. But that is not, by the way, the Antec P183. But the best thing for me about the Antec P183 is there is no big glass window on the side. So I might say that you know, having lots of space behind the motherboard or around the motherboard to hide things is great. But just having an old school case with no glass window on the side can be a huge, huge step towards making your cable management look better because nobody can see what you did. Just saying.
Yep.
Oh my goodness. PC Perta this week. Anything exciting coming up?
We have, we'll have that Corsair Air 540 review up now, obviously. Now that I called myself out on that. We also got in the new MSI GTX 780 Lightning card, which is their highest end GTX 780 card. Lots of overclocking capability on there. It will be interesting to compare it to that ASUS DirectCU 780. And then we're working on some AMD iFinity versus NVIDIA Surround performance testing as well, not just 4K, but we're looking at the triple monitor stuff. So maybe we'll have something up on that next week as well. But there's kind of a whole lot of testing that's going on for that in order to make sure we get a lot of stuff correct. So,
oh my goodness, we have done some torture testing to IOSafe's N2, which I will not reveal. But Alan Malvantano did a really good write up of the IOSafe N2 on PCPer.com. Looking at it, it's astonishing. It's outstanding performance. But it's essentially, it's like a 28-pound dual drive NAS enclosure, RAID-based NAS enclosure that's designed to survive 1,500-degree fires or being submerged for several days and has the ability to be chained down should you be worried about the security of your data. We'll talk about that next week on TechZilla and HD Nation. We've been having a lot of fun with some of the new panels. We actually had Samsung's latest, maybe the best plasma of 2013. And we are hopefully going to get a very interesting interview with one of the Wirecutters contributors talking about their favorite $500 LED HD TV. Say that three times fast. Oh my goodness. And we had some interesting conversations this week about why we're not really huge fans of Android sticks. Because we have some people that are they love the idea of the Chromecast, but they want something more open. And we talk about why sometimes you just want to buy a Roku 3 or an Apple TV. That's coming up on HD Nation. That's about it for this episode of Twitch. Twitch, TWICH at twit.tv is the email address, at Ryan Shrout and at Patrick Norton on the at Twitter. Which I guess technically is Twitter. And that's about it for this episode. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Shrout.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.
I just saw the news on Twitter that Ben Affleck's going to be Batman. So there you go.
Really? Oh, dude, you're going to love this so much. Burke, brace yourself. Are you sitting down? You sitting your hands for me? Back away from the console? Ben provides an interesting counterbalance to Henry's Superman, director Zack Snyder said in the statement. He has the acting chops to create a layered portrayal of a man who is older and wiser than Clark Kent and bears the scars of a seasoned crime fighter, but retains the charm that the world sees in billionaire Bruce Wayne. I can't wait to work with him.
Word dog.
Yeah, I love you, Ben Affleck, and your movie directing has been phenomenal, but I remember Daredevil. I'm just saying.